Irish. And today we're going to be thinking together about the idea of redemption. And redemption is an interesting subject because we think, what does it mean? How is it related to other things? And we will explore that a bit in today's talk. As many of you probably know, this year the church is celebrating 1700 years since the Council of Nicaea and the first iteration of the Nicene Creed. And of our four topics that we're covering in this season of Faith Forum, redemption is the only one of these four that's not actually mentioned in the Creed. But I think it's still important. So off we go. Do not fear. I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. These words from Isaiah 43, verse 1, are God's words of comfort to his people in exile. But what does it mean to be redeemed? This word occurs a lot in both Old and New Testaments, and it's a key idea in Christian theology, closely linked to salvation, but not interchangeable with it, which is why we're having an entire other faith forum on salvation next month. So, to redeem something in common parlance is to buy it back or to reclaim it, such as one might do with an item taken to a pawn shop. Or you might redeem a voucher in exchange for goods or services or something else of value. What has any of that got to do with the theological idea of redemption? Well, I would like to suggest just this. When something or someone is redeemed, it is claimed by or returned to its rightful owner, or to someone entitled to claim it. And when we encounter that concept in the concept of redemption in the Bible, this is indeed what we see. Within the book of Leviticus are rules for how to live in community as God's people. Now, these rules fully acknowledge the reality of life within a human civilization, that there will be inequality, that some people will be prosperous, some will fall into debt. But acknowledging that reality is not the same as accepting it. And so Leviticus makes provision for what should happen when a person finds himself, or perhaps herself, in financial difficulty. Quote, if any one of your kin falls into difficulty and sells a piece of property, then the next of kin shall come and redeem what the relative has sold. If the person has no one to redeem it, but then prospers and finds sufficient means to do so, the years since its sale shall be computed, and the difference shall be refunded to the person to whom it was sold, and the property shall be returned. If there are not sufficient means to cover it, what was sold shall remain with the purchaser until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee, it shall be released, and the property shall be returned. If anyone sells a dwelling house in a walled city, it may be redeemed until a year has elapsed since its sale. The right of redemption shall be for 1 year. If it is not redeemed before a full year has elapsed, a house that is in a walled city shall pass in perpetuity to the purchaser throughout the generations. It shall not be released in the Jubilee. But houses in villages that have no walls around them shall be classed as open country. They may be redeemed and they shall be released in the Jubilee. So, in other words, if a member of the Israelite community was forced through financial hardship to sell a piece of property, family members had a duty to buy it back for the one in financial trouble if they had the means. But even if that wasn't possible, whoever bought the property was under obligation to sell it back to the original owner at a fair price, should the original owner ever be in the position to buy it back. And even if that never happened, in the year of Jubilee, the property was to be returned to its original owner, with that, the exception of those houses within a walled city. So the original owner had the right of redemption, the right to reclaim what was originally his or hers. And this is important. I did consult with an expert colleague, John Barton, on this. But the idea of redeeming land is particularly important for ancient Israel because, of course, the land was appropriated, apportioned to the different tribes of Israel by God. It was God's decision who got what, and therefore it's not for human beings to change that. But the underlying idea of that right to reclaim what belongs to you because God has willed it, those things go closely together. And this right of redemption also applied if a person fell into financial difficulty and had to sell him or herself into slavery. Another member of that person's family had the right to buy the person back out of slavery, or if the person acquired money, he or she could redeem him or herself. Interesting side note, Leviticus says that Hebrew could only own a non-Hebrew slave. So if a Hebrew was selling himself or herself into slavery, presumably then it was to a resident alien who was also under obligation to follow the law and honor the right of redemption. Leviticus clearly links this right of redemption from slavery to God bringing the people out of slavery in Egypt. And this, I think, is where we find another important theological connection. This is at its heart about the relationship of God to God's people. They became slaves in Egypt and God redeemed them. In other words, and I think this comes through pretty clearly when we read the story of the Exodus, God reclaimed from Pharaoh what was God's. The people were restored to their right. Well, I don't really like to use the word owner, but I can't think of anything better. So before we leave the story of the Exodus, we should probably also look at its relationship to the system of animal sacrifice described in the Old Testament and the meaning of redemption in that context. Exodus chapter 13, verses 10 to 15 gives this instruction. When the Lord has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your ancestors, and has given it to you, you shall set apart to the Lord all that first opens the womb. All the firstborn of your livestock that are males shall be the Lord's, but every firstborn donkey that you shall redeem with a sheep. If you do not redeem it, you must break its neck. Every firstborn male among your children you shall redeem. When in the future your child asks you, what does this mean? You shall answer, by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, from the house of slavery. When Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from human firstborn to the firstborn of animals. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord every male that first opens the womb, but every firstborn of my sons I redeem. The death of the firstborns in Egypt was what finally convinced Pharaoh to let the people go. It was directly linked to their redemption. And so the firstborn of every animal is sacrificed to God in honor of that. The exception to this being the donkey, an animal that many households might have had. But my understanding is that because it was considered a ritually unclean animal, it wasn't suitable for sacrifice, hence redeeming it with a sheep. Human firstborn males were also redeemed with an animal because God does not permit human sacrifice. The redemption here is, we might say, buying back with an alternative animal. We could also think of that redeeming of one animal with another, or redeeming the firstborn son with a sheep, as a kind of redeeming one from death. This idea of redeeming from death, which is probably closer to what most Christians think of when we think of the idea of redemption, is found clearly in the book of Job. In Job 5:20, God is described as one who, quote, in famine will redeem you from death, and in war from the power of the sword. Later in the book of Job, when Job's so-called friends are trying to convince him that he must have done something terrible to cause all his suffering, Elihu tries to convince Job that he should pray to God for forgiveness because if his prayers are heard, he will be redeemed from death. Elihu posits a hypothetical sinner who's forgiven and says, he has redeemed my soul from going down to the pit, and my life shall see the light. As with redemption from slavery in Egypt, this redemption is about rescue and restoration. And although perhaps not quite so obviously, it's about being returned to God. In this case, being returned to God through being returned to right relationship with God. Being redeemed by God is unsurprisingly mentioned several times in the Psalms. I won't go through all of the Psalms that mention redemption, but we'll look at a selection. Psalm 31, verse 5 will, I'm sure, be a familiar verse to many of you. Into your hand I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord, faithful God. According to Luke's account of the Passion, Jesus cries out the words of the first half of this verse from the cross just before he dies. Luke says, then Jesus, crying with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. Having said this, he breathed his last. Now, I believe I'm right in saying that in the Jewish tradition, to quote one part of a psalm is to, in effect, make reference to the whole of the psalm. So this cry from Jesus may be his way of acknowledging, even at the moment of death, that God has redeemed him from death. Much of Psalm 31 is a prayer for deliverance from one's enemies and from death, but at verse 21, it takes a turn. Blessed be the Lord, for he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me when I was beset as a city under siege. I had said in my alarm, I am driven far from your sight, but you heard my supplications when I cried out for your help. So in his cry from the cross, Jesus is, I believe, affirming his trust in God to deliver him from death, and also that God will redeem him in the sense of bringing him back into God's possession, as it were. Where do I get this? From verse 22 in the psalm. I had said in my alarm, I am driven far from your sight, but you heard my supplications. There had been a separation, but God heard the plea and restored the relationship, brought the psalmist and Jesus back into God's presence and possession. Psalm 34 is slightly different in that it's a psalm of praise and thanksgiving for deliverance from trouble. So the rescue's already happened. But it ends with these words: the Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. Psalm 44 also ends by speaking of redemption. But in this case, it's a plea for redemption. And again, this is linked to the need to be restored to God's presence. So Psalm 44, beginning at verse 23, says, rouse yourself. Why do you sleep, O God? Awake, do not cast us off forever. Why do you hide your face? Why do you forget our affliction and oppression? For we sink down to the dust, our bodies cling to the ground. Rise up, come to our help. Redeem us for the sake of your steadfast love. People feel they have been cast off from God's presence and they need him to redeem them, to reclaim them, and bring them back to himself. And we see something very similar in Psalm 69 as well, but I'm not going to read it out. Here, we'd be here all afternoon. Psalm 103 is another psalm of thanksgiving for deliverance from trouble that brings together deliverance and redemption. But here we also get a link between redemption and renewal. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and do not forget all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquity, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy, who satisfies you with good as long as you live, so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. What these verses seem to be telling us is that when God redeems us, reclaims us as his own, and brings us back into his presence and possession, that's not the end. That's the beginning. Once we are back in God's presence, our needs are satisfied and we are given good so that we are renewed. And I think that idea of renewal being connected to redemption is a key part of the Christian understanding of redemption. And we'll come back to that shortly. Well, before we move on to the New Testament and how the concept of redemption is presented there, I'd first like us to spend some time with the prophets. It's always profitable to spend time with the prophets. The idea of redemption or the day of redemption is, as we might expect, central to the message of the prophets who were writing at the time of the exile. The promise that one day God would redeem his people, reclaim them for his own, and bring them back to the promised land. It was vital in sustaining hope and cultural identity. Isaiah chapter 35 is all about the day that the redeemed return to the land, and verses 8 to 10 describe it this way: a highway shall be there. And it shall be called the Holy Way. The unclean shall not travel on it, but it shall be for God's people. No traveler, not even fools, shall go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come upon it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. God's redemption of his people will be so complete that not even fools will get lost on the way home. And there will be no ravenous or dangerous beasts to devour them along the way. Isaiah doesn't stop there, however. The redemption of God's people comes up again in chapter 43, the first verse of which I quoted at the start of this talk, and which opens with these verses. So this is verses 1 to 7 of that chapter. But now, thus says the Lord, He who created you, O Jacob, He who formed you, O Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Saviour. I give Egypt as your ransom, Ethiopia and Seba in exchange for you, because you are precious in my sight and honored, and I love you. I give people in return for you, nations in exchange for your life. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bring your offspring from the east, and from the west I will gather you. I will say to the north, give them up, and to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from far away and my daughters from the ends of the earth. Everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory, whom I formed and made. The words of the Lord that Isaiah declares here state plainly that God is reclaiming his own, demanding that other lands give them up and not withhold them. More than that, he declares that he is giving other peoples in exchange for them. And I think we'd probably all agree that God could claim every nation as his own, because he is the creator of all that is. Of course, Israel were his special people, and he gives others in ransom. The promise of redemption for God's people is declared again in Isaiah 52, which recalls the people being redeemed from Egypt and gives hope that God will again redeem and rescue his people and restore them to their homeland. And the prophet Micah also speaks of God's redeeming his people, but it's clear that there will first be a period of exile. You shall go to Babylon. There you shall be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the hands of your enemies. Micah 4:10. The concept of being in exile and needing redemption is one that underscores our understanding of Jesus and his mission and ministry. The exile in Jesus' time, however, wasn't one of being physically exiled from the land, but one of spiritual exile. And the evidence for this was the occupation of Israel and Judah by a foreign pagan nation, namely Rome. The song of Zechariah, as he rejoices at the birth of his son John the Baptist, begins with these words: Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, for he has looked favorably on his people and redeemed them, or in some translations, set them free. Now, very near the beginning of Luke's gospel, we encounter this concept of God rescuing his people from captivity or slavery, redeeming them, reclaiming them as his own. And Luke revisits the theme of redemption towards the end of the gospel. The disciples walking along the road to Emmaus say of Jesus, but we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. In other words, they had hoped, believed that Jesus was the one who would restore Israel to God's possession, bring Israel back into God's presence. Of course, that's exactly what Jesus did. They just didn't realize it quite yet. We also find the idea of Jesus as the one who redeems in Paul's writings. But unsurprisingly, given that it's Paul, the theology is a bit complex. In Galatians chapter 3, verse 13, Paul writes, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. Now, when Paul speaks of the curse of the law, he's referring to something he said a few verses earlier in verse 10, for all who rely on the works of the law are under a curse, for it is written, Cursed is the one who does not observe and obey all the things written in the book of the law. So what he's saying is that no one can hope to observe and obey everything in the law all the time, and therefore all who try to live by the law end up failing and are cursed. But Jesus redeemed us by his crucifixion, rescuing and restoring those who had failed under the law by giving his own life. In chapter 4, Paul expands on this idea, speaking of those who are under the law as essentially slaves, the law being their guardian or supervisor. Jesus then redeems those who are enslaved as, ne as a next of kin would redeem an enslaved relative, so that they can become adopted children and heirs in the family of God. Again, we are here encountering this idea of restoration and I think of renewal, as the redeemed person is not just freed, but given a new place and identity within the family, not merely kin, which could indicate either a close or a distant relationship, but now adopted as a child and heir. In the letter to Titus, we again see the idea of Jesus giving his own life to redeem us, to rescue us. Quote, "He it is who gave himself for us that he might redeem us from all iniquity and purify for himself a people of his own who are zealous for good deeds." That's Titus 2, verse 14. Think that idea of renewal is in there as well. The idea of once we're redeemed, we become zealous for good deeds, eager to do good in response to our redemption. The author to the letter of the Hebrews also picks up the idea of Jesus redeeming his people through his death, linking it explicitly to the Jewish sacrificial system and hence to purification and sanctification that is being made holy. In chapter 9, verses 11 to 15, the author of the letter to the Hebrews writes, "But when Christ came as high priest for the of the good things that have come, then through the greater and perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy place, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls, with the sprinkling of the ashes of a heifer, sanctifies those who have been defiled so that their flesh is purified, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to worship the living God? For this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, because a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions under the first covenant." So here, the redemption is a restoration almost akin to restoring a battered old antique, cleaning it up and repairing it so that it's restored to mint condition. The end result being redemption, as we've been thinking about it throughout this talk, restoration to God's presence, to worship, and to the promised eternal inheritance, but cleaned up so that we're worthy to be in God's presence. Finally, revelation. You have to end in Revelation. In Revelation chapter 14, verses 1 to 4, we are told about the song of the redeemed. Here, the redeemed in question aren't all believers, but those who are redeemed first, who have a prized place before the throne of God and whose song is central to the heavenly worship. Quote, "Then I looked, and there was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him were 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the sound of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they sing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who have been redeemed from the earth. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. These follow the Lamb wherever he goes. They have been redeemed from humankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth was no lie found. They are blameless." Revelation, of course, ends with the new heaven and the new earth, or as some theologians would argue, the renewed heaven and the renewed earth, and the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven and God coming to dwell with God's people. And the river of life flowing out from God's throne, and the tree of life that gives healing to the nations. Revelation ends with restoration and renewal. Redemption is a complex concept. As I said at the start, it's related to salvation, but it's not quite the same thing. Redemption in both Old and New Testaments is about rescuing or saving, so it's clearly related to salvation. But it is a rescue specifically tied to being reclaimed by God, the one who is our rightful keeper. And it's about being restored to right relationship with God and restored to God's presence and possession. It's about being renewed and revived. So hear the words of the Lord to his people. "Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine."